new recommendations for screening for pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes.
Can antibodies tell you whether the COVID vaccine is effective or not?
Increasing incidence of both type 1 and type 2 diabetes among young people in the U.S.
And the potential for developing vaccines against current and future coronavirus.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we turn first to the preprint server, MedRxiv? This is clearly a preprint, but it's taking a look at this important issue of whether antibodies can predict whether someone is going to be able to overcome a SARS-CoV-2 infection.
All right. And so, Elizabeth, these are an analysis of the individuals enrolled in one of the Moderna mRNA COVID vaccine trials, where they looked to see how effective the vaccine was, but also had antibody levels and four different types of antibodies, a couple what are called binding antibodies to different parts of the coronavirus, and then neutralizing antibodies. And here's what they determined. Well, first of all, we know that it's 95% effective in preventing COVID infection. Well, the next question they ask is, well, how does that correlate with antibody levels? They drew antibody levels 29 and 57 days after the vaccine, and they followed them for 3 to 4 months. But then they correlated antibody levels to risk of infection for those 5% that actually got infected. And what they determined was there was an inverse relationship. That is, the higher the antibody level, the less likely the individuals were to actually develop COVID infection. That suggests that there is a direct relationship between antibody level and infection. They were even able to narrow it down to give kind of cutoff values. What they determined is that if you look at the day 29 and 57 antibody levels, for the people that had either the lowest amount or undetectable binding or neutralizing antibody, their effectiveness of the vaccine was only 45 to 60%. For those that had the highest level, it was above 98%. What the hope is that we'll actually be able to use the antibody level as kind of a surrogate marker. So if you develop a certain level, that would predict vaccine effectiveness. And we wouldn't have to wait for months and months, but we could determine it as early as 29 days after the vaccine was given.
So this seems like a hopeful strategy. One of the questions clearly that I have is that as variants are developing, and what are we going to do about this antibody level? These are antibodies to that wild type that we had low these many months ago.
There's several considerations about this trial. You mentioned one, how does this predict effectiveness against variants? Secondly, is they just follow these people for 3 to 4 months, and we actually want to know if it predicts vaccine effectiveness over the course of a year or 2 years. And the third thing is this just correlated with the risk of infection. It didn't correlate antibodies with the seriousness of the infection. Were these patients hospitalized or died? So there are additional information that needs to be done, but this is at least a preliminary investigation showing that the antibody levels may be a surrogate marker.
I think the other thing that would be interesting would be to see about these antibody levels and whether they could predict whether somebody would really need a booster, because as you know, we're coming into a lot of international scrutiny about whether we ought to be offering people boosters. And what about if you could draw an antibody level and say, you know what, your antibodies are so high, you really don't need one.
Yeah, and there are several things that go in that, because what accounts for an immune response is not only antibody levels, but the ability of your B cells to make additional antibodies, and then a T cell response as well. And it may be that antibody levels, as we know, they decline over time, but if these other mechanisms are truly active, maybe the antibody level doesn't tell the whole story a year or two down the road. As we begin to give boosters and develop more information, I think we'll be able to ascertain whether antibody levels are really the whole story or not.
Let's turn to JAMA. The USPSTF has stepped into the space of saying what's the screening recommendation relative to pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes. No surprise to anybody, of course, that diabetes is increasing in incidence, and we know tons and tons of information about the negative sequela of that. They reviewed all the literature, as is their wont. They had 89 publications, and they looked at differences between screening and control groups for all-cause and cause-specific mortality at 10 years. They also looked at harms, of course, and they came up with basically, and I'm going to make this really short, lots of things about overweight people. Sure, intensive glucose control with metformin improves their health outcomes. Lifestyle interventions are also important with improving intermediate outcomes, such as reduced weight, body mass index, systolic blood pressure. They didn't really change these recommendations significantly at all from the previous set that they had had, except for that they moved slightly younger in terms of maybe should be screening people at 35 rather than 40.
Yep. The recommendation is for individuals 35 to 70 that are overweight or obese is do some screening looking for prediabetes or diabetes. It's estimated that about 13% of all U.S. adults over the age of 18 have diabetes, and about a third meet the criteria for prediabetes. Complications, leading cause of kidney failure, leading cause of blindness, cardiovascular disease, liver disease, yada, yada, yada. So you're right. After all this review, it just lowered the age a little bit, but actually you can make the case that this is the group that's likely to benefit the most because they're more likely to have it for a longer period of time and to suffer the consequences. And what you want to do is you want to identify it earlier and begin to address it. One of the unfortunate things, Elizabeth, when you look over the last 10 years, we really haven't moved the needle on having individuals have properly controlled blood pressure and sugar. Less than 25% of all Americans that have prediabetes or diabetes have properly controlled sugar and blood pressure. And when you look at the minorities, it's under 10 to 15%.
Right, and they identify this as stagnation of the management of diabetes, which is kind of a daunting term. I guess I would ask you, if people aren't going to do these things, then what's the point of even identifying them earlier?
Yeah, the group that's particularly recalcitrant are young adults. We need to have new science, new ideas, new frameworks for addressing this particular group.
Let's turn now to the New England Journal of Medicine, something that might be a bit more uplifting. Gosh, can we develop something that would actually intervene in all of the coronaviruses that are out there rather than just SARS-CoV-2?
I'm going to frame this up. We're going to talk about something called sarbecovirus. I'm going to have people think about it as a family tree. You have grandparents, you have parents, and then a group of kids. And these are the way that viruses are organized as well. If we think of the grandparent as being the beta coronavirus, we think about their kids as being sarbecovirus and the grandkids as being the coronaviruses. And they all share some genetic information, but they're not all identical. In the coronavirus, we've talked before about the fact that the COVID infection isn't the first coronavirus infection. We had SARS in early 2000, and we had MERS in the mid-2010s. Then we have COVID. So they share about 80% of the genetic material. What that means is if you have a SARS or MERS infection, you're not protected against COVID. If you had a COVID infection, you're not protected against SARS or MERS. But let's take it a step further. Instead of developing vaccines against all of the children, what if we develop vaccines that were a step above that, the parent level? That's called sarbecovirus. And that's what this paper addressed. They took a group of individuals that had MERS and SARS, and they gave them the COVID vaccine. And what they determined is by vaccinating against both of those, they had developed antibodies not only against those viruses, but another 8 or 10 that are variants. What the authors are saying is if we address one level up, develop antibodies to the sarbecovirus, it may take care of all the coronaviruses that we see now and in the future as well.
All right. So talk to me about the model that they used for this.
So what they're talking about is a future vaccine that targets the earlier coronavirus, that is the SARS and the MERS, and a second vaccine, a booster, that targets the other family members, and it will protect against a much wider variety of coronaviruses in the future.
This is reminding me of this notion that one of these days, in the foreseeable future, we're going to have a universal influenza vaccine.
Bingo. That's a great term. I wish I'd use that. We're talking about a pan-sarbecovirus, but what you're talking about is a better term. It's a universal vaccine. You just give it once. You may need a booster, but it protects not only against what's going on now, but the variants that come in the future. And that's a problem we're addressing right now.
So I like this hopeful study, and I wish we could stop here, but we can't. We're going to turn back to JAMA, something I'm going to make very short work of, basically this survey of what's going on with type 1 and type 2 diabetes among individuals younger than 20 years of age in the United States. And to assess this, they looked at 6 areas in the U.S., 4 geographic areas, 1 health plan, and select American Indian reservations. And the bad news is that there have been increases in both of these things, both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, a greater percentage increase in the type 2 diabetes, type 1 largely impacting non-Hispanic white youth as well as non-Hispanic Blacks, and type 2 impacting much more often the Black individuals as well as Hispanic youth. It's unclear to me. We have, of course, lots of strategies for intervening in type 2 diabetes. I do not know why the incidence of type 1 is increasing. I'm not sure anybody else knows either. So trying to target that, we don't have an intervention.
It's unfortunate that over the 16-year period, type 1 diabetes in kids and adolescents has increased 50% and type 2 has increased 100%. You're right, type 1 diabetes is a combination of environmental factors and genetic factors that predispose to people having immune response to their pancreas. It's not clear exactly what those environmental factors are. The genetic factors don't change. Type 2 diabetes, though, that's preventable. I mean, that's due to primarily childhood obesity and inactivity as well. And the fact that both have increased substantially over the last 16 years is disappointing.
Very disappointing. And also, as you pointed out, relative to the USPSDF recommendations, the longer you got it, the more likely you're going to develop the dire outcomes.
Yeah, it's important that, again, we get our hands around and address this early on, not only to kids, but to parents as well, because parents control a lot of the eating habits that obviously kids exhibit. And then it needs to happen at the school level as well.
Okay, on that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Black. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.